we need a new open for it, because now we have 75 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
You're right. Do you have any ideas for what you would want to say? Do we have a catchphrase?
Do we have a catchphrase? I don't know. Catchphrase? Don't quit.
Welcome back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quinn Kesnick. And Quinn, what a week four it was. Unbelievable. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday action. And let's start with Sunday, and we'll work our way backwards. We just watched North Carolina hold on to beat Denver 15-13 in the Mile High City. Earlier on ESPNU, Cornell held on to beat Ohio State 17-16 in the Horseshoe. Both top 10 teams going on the road, getting good wins, but both teams were leading considerably late. Cornell was up 16-10 and had to make a game-saving save at the end of regulation, and then Carolina was up by scores of both 9-2 and 13-5 to start the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I watched a ton of the Cornell-Ohio State game and have a lot of respect for Cornell. When you lose 30 faceoffs in a game and you still win and still score, 17 goals? That's really impressive. That offense is really clicking. Jeff Teat, he's got to be on your Tuareton list in terms of being top five player in the country. Bad news is that they thought they fixed their faceoff issues, Cornell did. The reality is that they were being masked by playing poor faceoff teams in the first three or four games of the year. So that still exists, and that's going to be a major issue for Cornell when they play Penn and Yale, two very good faceoff teams in their conference. But this is a big win. I mean, I thought both road teams could be picked against today in terms of upsets. Ohio State covered the spread. Denver, I don't think, did. But I was really impressed with Cornell to go on the road in the Horseshoe. Ohio State has not been playing well. You knew they had the extra day. They're going to come out firing. And so it's a nice win for the Ivy League. And then the second game, I didn't get to see as much of it as I would have liked, but I caught the last, 12 minutes of the game. And it's hard to believe, Terry, that North Carolina won that game by the score they did, because if you watch the last 10 minutes, Denver dominated play.
It's true, but if you watch the first 45 minutes, I just kept coming away from that action with this whole, how is Denver going to score goals? And it's such a weird feeling to have for a Pioneer team that in the Bill Tierney, Matt Brown era has not struggled to either generate slides, get good open looks, or whatever the case may be.
Whoa. I've always felt in the last 5 years that Denver lacked Dodgers, that they had to do some tricky things to get guys free. I mean, Hannah looks like he can run by his man. How many guys on that offense?
Well, that was the point I was going to make, is that, yeah,
you can run by their guy.
You thought you were going to get more out of Alex Simmons heading into this season. He did have a nice inside role against Will Bowen to kind of get that party started, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, some of these guys, I mean, really the fact that Skylar Blair is being relied upon as a consistent ball carrier, and he's got four goals through four games, zero assists. You know, there's clearly something from an offensive personnel standpoint that they're searching for, that they're looking for. And I think that there are a lot of positives that you can take away from that fourth corner. And I agree with you. Jack Hanna has a big part to do with it. He looks so much like Tyler Pace wearing that number three jersey. He's just a big body who can step into a shot. And I think he can spread defenses out a little bit. And it seems like that's going to be, you know, Denver's best opportunity, because they need space to work on the interior and space to work on the backside. And when Hannah can get some of that gravitational force pulled toward him, then I think that is the catalyst that looks like it might be able to yield dividends going forward.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting for Denver because Duke jumped all over them early, ACC team, and held on for the win. Same with Carolina. Good news for Denver is they turn around. They still have some quality non-conference games. They play Notre Dame, Ohio State before starting the conference. So that gives them hope that maybe if you beat Notre Dame and Ohio State, you know, potentially you could be one of the last at-large selections. But it's not looking good right now. I mean, it really appears as if the ACC is going to eat up, five of the at-large selections, correct?
Yeah. I mean, certainly when you look up and down the conference, you're not looking at a team that you're, expecting to be on the outside looking in. They made a comment during the broadcast that the ACC coaches picked North Carolina finished last, and they're in the conversation alongside another ACC team in Syracuse for, and we'll get to this at the end of the podcast, who is the number one team heading into week five?
Well, I
It's a
mean,
very open
those
question.
coaches still may be correct.
Well, true.
And in my view, North Carolina is closer to the bottom of the ACC right now than they are to the top.
So one of the things that if you're North Carolina, you got to feel good about is that you were able to put up 15 goals against Denver on the road without needing an explosive day from Chris Gray. Couple notes from Denver's defense. Colin Squires made his first start of the season after battling injuries for the first month, and Jack Thompson made his first start in goal. He finished with 10 saves. I thought that he was consistent. I would like to see them stick with him going forward because I do think that, compared to the, kind of rotating goalie that they've been dealing with for the last couple seasons, including so far this year, with two different guys, or Thompson being the third guy to start a game so far, I think he's probably the most consistent option going forward. But the Tar Heels got a big day out of Justin Anderson. He had 5 goals and 2 assists, and then it was pretty well spread around. Beyond that, Gray had 2 and 2. Brian Cameron and Nicky Solomon each had 2 goals. William Perry had a goal and 2 assists. Both Scherzinger brothers got on the board, including opening up the scoring for the day. So a good kind of all-around offensive performance for North Carolina.
I think Syracuse has the best first midfield in the country. I think North Carolina is ranked second, but North Carolina's attack is much better than Syracuse's attack. And I think that when you look at offenses, just the top six, let's say you're going to put out there, I mean, Carolina has got to be in your top three nationally. I would think Cornell would be another team that you have to respect. And then you got to talk Michael Sowers and Princeton, perhaps. But I have enormous amounts of respect for North Carolina's offense. Tucci did a nice job facing off today. Caton Johnson's not giving up soft goals, and the defense is played quite honestly against Hopkins. I thought they had a little second, third period there where they played really well. So they've done better than I expected.
Well, just a couple more notes on Cornell as we tie the bow on Sunday. And I would be remiss not to mention that Duke beat Furman 19-6 to put together a 2-win weekend. We're going to talk about their overtime victory versus Richmond, a game that you called as the podcast moves forward. And then Virginia hosted Air Force and sent the Falcons back to Colorado Springs with a 15-5 loss. But you mentioned Cornell's offense, and oh my goodness, particularly out of the gates when they were not getting the ball, were they incredibly efficient every time they touched it? And this was Mecca Long's debut on national TV after having played in the Under Armour All-America game last summer. And I was so impressed by him against High Point. We talked about it on the podcast last week and his ability to put pressure on defenses. And when you combine the likes of Jonathan Donville and Jack Piattelli just flanking and kind of creating a circle all around the offensive zone to be picked apart by Teat, I thought the biggest it was similar to the point that I made about Carolina's offense being good without Gray. I thought it was meaningful that Cornell's offense was productive on a day when Connor Fletcher and Cooper Telesco were otherwise a little bit quiet.
The offense, again, I'll make the point. You know, what I like about it is you have different skill sets. You got Teats, the passer, but now Long can run a little quarterback himself to alleviate some of the pressure on Jeff. Although I would have liked to seen the ball and Jeff stick more towards the end of the game. A little baffling on some of those late possessions that Teat is a spectator. But Piattelli played a masterful game today, just picking his spots, understanding that the defense really doesn't respect him like they should. Donville, sensational off ball. Fletcher can run downhill. He can hit the outside shot. Telesco, as I said, is like a running back, playing midfield. So it's a really, really interesting group. The assembly of talent is dynamic and vibrant. And so, they got to figure out the face-off department because otherwise, man, that's a tough team to deal with. Cornell's going to score goals on everybody.
Yeah, the last guy I want to mention is Gavin Adler, number 77, little guy. He was guarding Jack Myers today. He dislodged him with 4 seconds to go in the third quarter off of a kind of quick restart situation that prevented Ohio State from getting a look. And then he ate a shot at the 7-12 mark of the fourth quarter by jumping into it and turning his back. It ended up yielding. It was a possession that yielded a goal for the Buckeyes. But those were two plays that stood out to me, alongside just, kind of hounding a really good attackman all day for, at this point now, the third or fourth consecutive game. I think Cornell is a team to continue to watch and a team to include in that conversation for best teams in the country. But Quint, we are burying the lead because for the second time in as many weeks, number one went down. The Yale Bulldogs went to Amherst, Massachusetts, and were handed a 13-10 defeat at the hand of hands of Greg Cannella's Gorillas. And, this is a game that I think Andy Shea and his staff kind of saw coming a little bit. Andy was formerly a assistant coach at UMass, has tremendous respect not just for the program, but Coach Cannella cites him as a mentor. They talk all the time, but they don't talk a ton week of a game. And I think he knows that UMass loves to play Yale tough. They played him tough in the NCAA tournament, I believe, two seasons ago. And I think, for that staff, they knew that coming off a clear beating Penn State, becoming the number one team in the country off of a week in which you cleared the ball at 50%, there was some work that needed to be done. Things weren't all right in New Haven, and I think the flaws kind of came home to roost in this one, particularly as UMass built leads of 6-1 and 10-2. They scored with 6 seconds left in the first half to go ahead 10-2, and then the second half was really just all about Yale kind of inching back, and there were points at which I thought they were going to be able to close the gap and make it all the way back, but then they clearly ran out of time and never really got into a point where they were only a couple of possessions away from being able to get the game back level.
This game reminded me a lot of Marist's win over Army, in that you had the harder working team, maybe not the team with as much talent, but the home team was the harder working team, celebrating the little plays that add up to possessions. And then timely shooting. And when things were falling apart, their goalie, was it Note, made those two big stops at the end. One a stick, off stick high from point blank range, the other five hole from point blank range. Who knows if Yale scores there? The game is going to get dicey because TD was continually winning faceoffs. So UMass and Greg Cannella deserve a lot of credit. Okay. At the beginning of the weekend, I sat down with Russ DeLynn. It was over lunch on Friday when we were in Durham. And I'm like, I can sense some upsets this weekend. And we went through them all just because of dynamics. Because sometimes the better team doesn't win, but that day, the better team in the stadium always wins. So Ohio State, I thought, had a shot to beat Cornell. They're at home taking on a Cornell team that really hasn't played much. Denver at home against Carolina, I could have seen that happening. We mentioned the Yale UMass game, and I'm like, I don't know about that one, but it wouldn't shock me. It could have, but I would have given that one a low percentage. But it just goes to show that everybody's good, and when you're not ready mentally, physically, spiritually, or schematically, you're going to get knocked off these days. Everybody's got good players, so give UMass credit. It gets them back into the top 20, and Yale can't come back as number one next week.
So Yale turned the ball over 16 times in the first half. They went 4 of 7 clearing the ball. You mentioned it was not an anomalous day from a faceoff standpoint. They did, dominate. TD Erland won 20 of 26 draws, but it was UMass's offensive efficiency, particularly in that first half, I felt like determined the outcome of the game. And their first three goals all came off of attacking short sticks. And there was a stretch in the middle of the second quarter after Yale scored to make it to take it from 6-1 to 6-2, UMass grabbed the game again by the scruff of the neck, took momentum. Kevin Tobin scored on a inside roll from X. It looked like Will Renz took a little bit of a knock on that play, and then the senior midfielder Billy Philpott scored two unassisted goals. The first on an S dodge from the lefty wing, and then the second on a righty sweep where he rolled back to his left, and the slide came adjacent, but it was just a little bit late, didn't make enough contact, and he got off a nice long range shot. those are the types of plays that ultimately lead to a upset win like this. And you're right. It was an interesting UMass season insofar as to lose such a one-sided game to Army early and then beat Ohio State. It was, I didn't mention this when we were talking about the Buckeyes, but one of the reasons I was so excited for this matchup against Cornell, and I was texting you this earlier in the week, like I had watched Ohio State play a couple times and I just didn't feel like I had my arms around who they were as a team. And it was weird because this wasn't a team that, was rolling out a ton of new offensive personnel, familiar with Jack Myers, familiar certainly with Trey LeClair, familiar with Jackson Reed, Lucas Buckley. These are guys that we've seen a ton over the years, and I just didn't feel like I knew who they were. And it was partly because this UMass Ohio State game was just such an outlier, or one that didn't necessarily reconcile with some of the rest of the results. And now to realize that, yeah, UMass is probably solidly a top 20 team. Ohio State is probably also right there as a solidly a top 20 team. The pieces are starting to fit together a little bit more.
I agree, and it really stamps UMass as the favorite in the CAA. Winless Towson, Delaware loses to Villanova, Hofstra beats LIU. I don't think Fairfield is in that caliber. Maybe Drexel will rise up, but UMass clearly the favorite in that league right now. The other thing I think it shows us about the Ivy League with Yale is that this is going to be a dogfight. Princeton again looks pretty good. Cornell's got the O. Penn just keeps losing one goal games against great competition. They've proved they can score. If they find a goalie who doesn't make boneheaded plays around the crease and can make a stop at crunch time, Penn might be undefeated right now. And then I think there's a drop off. Dartmouth's undefeated. Harvard's going to be a little better down the road, and then you got Brown. So Ivy League, as we've talked about exclusively the last 2 weeks, is on the rise.
In College Park, the Maryland Terrapins handed Notre Dame a 14-9 defeat. It was a cold, cold day in Maryland Stadium, but it was a big day on campus. College game day was there for the Terps men's basketball team's night game versus Michigan State. Scott Van Pelt was on site both for game day and then for the men's lacrosse game. Certainly, the women's lacrosse game had a surprisingly unexpected game relocated from the Carrier Dome. And now, just a quick aside, Maryland's women's team is 1-3 for the first time since, I believe, 2001 after losing 10-5 to Syracuse yesterday. But
Yeah,
for.
raise your hand if you're rooting for Syracuse yesterday.
I
Raise your
think that
hand,
there are a
everybody.
lot of people raising their hand right now. Certainly,
I you know, I don't want to dig myself a grave, but I was rooting for Syracuse yesterday.
So back to the topic at hand, this is a Maryland offense that took 64 shots. Logan Wisnowskis accounted for 17 of those, and he led the way with 5 goals. It was a Maryland team that hadn't played in 10 days after their game against Navy was canceled the Saturday prior due to that outbreak of norovirus among the midshipman squad. So they had been sitting on that loss to Villanova for a week and a half. Coach John Tillman said post-game that there was a lot of benefit from that extra time off because of how many guys had gotten sick on their team and how many injuries started to kind of recover a little bit and nurse back to health. And I think that you also saw the opportunity to make some more systemic and strategic and schematic changes to the Terrapins as well as they started freshman goalie Logan McNanny for the first time. John Gepper moved up to LSM, and Nick Grill, Brett Makar, and Ray Hill started down low defensively. And I thought that that was kind of the story of the game. This was a game that was tied 7-7 about 5 minutes into the third quarter after Notre Dame scored the first 2 goals of the second half. And it was at that point, I was just like, how is this game tied? Notre Dame had failed on 5 of their first 14 clearing attempts. Justin Shockey was dominating the faceoff X. So really, it was Notre Dame was kind of playing well at both ends of the field, but they were getting destroyed in the middle of the field. And then from that point on, they really weren't doing anything at either end of the field. And Coach Kevin Corrigan was pretty vocal about that post game, just how they didn't play competitively. They didn't try to win their matchups offensively or defensively and get good looks. And, as a result, that offense petered out. And I think you give a lot of credit to Maryland's defense. I thought that, they did a nice job finishing possessions. And I think that they, particularly once Notre Dame started to become more consistent and effective clearing the ball, they didn't give up transition opportunities. They didn't give up easy looks. And I thought that one of the things that I'm going to watch moving forward was Patrick Kavanaugh was really, the freshman, Matt Kavanaugh's younger brother, really effective as a facilitator and quarterback in the first two games, was very quiet in this one. And I think
Yeah,
that.
no, I thought he was quiet against Richmond too. He didn't do much ball handling against Richmond. He was just
Okay.
merely a shooter. I thought that Grip Westland and McCann were much more ball carrier oriented in that Richmond game.
Quinn McCann was all over the field against Maryland. He played a ton of defense, and he was particularly effective
Great
offensively
athlete.
early.
Yes. And I thought Westland did a lot of the wing penetration against Richmond. So Notre Dame's issues, again, the first midfield didn't shoot it well the other day. That tends to happen to the Fighting Irish. What are they, 3 of 17 as a group?
They just didn't take very
But
many shots either. They finished with that. At one point in the game, it was like the shooting disparity was like 52 to 20. I mean, it just was as if Notre
yeah,
Dame wasn't, they just weren't getting the ball out of their stick.
no, it's a shocker to see them give up 64 shots with that defense, because everybody who they had played talked about their defense as being suffocating. That was the word Richmond Dan Chamati, who I had on their Friday game, so I ended up watching a lot of that Notre Dame Richmond tape. But he said, "Yeah, Notre Dame suffocating. We couldn't win anything close to a matchup on the perimeter." But Logan Wisnowskis all of a sudden is like Kenny Loggins. He's all right. You see him go around the goal twice, right-handed, and
I
score.
did.
I'm unbelievable. I mean, his game is growing, man. He's always had that lefty rip from the wing with his feet set for mid-range. He's a kind of attackman I hated to play against because of his height. Just creating different shooting angles, the release point always screwed you up as well. Bernhardt's consistent as they get, and Maryland's getting more production now, I think, deeper in the roster. The goalie move surprised me, okay? Not that, Brandow gave up some goals from distance. I actually wrote about it in my poll. You watch the Villanova tape, Villanova scores like 3 or 4 goals from outside 13. And Villanova's got some cannons from the outside, which is a trend, by the way, across the country. But you don't know what's going on in practice, okay? And so often fans will say, "Oh, you got to bench that goalie. You gave up 2 or 3 bad goals." Or, it's the accumulation of your performance Monday through Saturday. It's not just a Saturday thing. When it becomes a Saturday thing, then the coaches sit back and say, "Well, is he making those same mistakes on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? Is he committing turnovers? Is he leading the defense?" So don't jump on a goalie for giving up a bad goal and saying you got to pull the guy. But that in that case, starting the freshman did surprise me. So you had a pair of freshman goalies in what was a very big game.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make a comment about Liam Entenmann. He finished with 16 saves. I
I like him.
think
I think he's going to be good.
that's what I was going to say. I think Notre Dame's goalie play has been, I don't want to say it's been like sneaky bad, but it really hasn't been consistent. They haven't felt like they had an unassailable goalie for at least 5 years, and I feel like I think Entenmann is going to present himself as that going forward. And I think that, it's just a really luxurious feeling to have as a coach and as a defense to feel like you know who that voice is going to be back there for the foreseeable future.
I agree, and they'll support it. The other thing is, again, we're talking about a team with a new defensive coordinator, and Jerry Byrne had such a methodical and a patented approach where he knew, I mean, the guy's been doing it so long that now with new voices there, I'm not sure how the strategy, it's not going to be as perfect maybe as it once was in terms of their rules and execution initially. It's going to get there. But I think that still is. This is kind of a wake-up call for Notre Dame on all fronts, and it'll be good for them because I do think they have a very good team.
I agree. I mean, just to kind of circle all the way back to the beginning of this, one of the things that I was most excited coming into this game was, I thought that they had had a really nice offensive day against Cleveland State, a really good defensive day against Richmond. I kind of had the feeling coming into this season that Notre Dame was a team that was going less talked about than their quality probably indicated. And so I felt like a really strong performance against Maryland was going to position them in a way where, maybe Notre Dame is the best team in the country, and we all have just not really noticed it. Certainly that didn't come to fruition. But I do want to echo your point. I think Notre Dame's going to be good, and I think that they're going to figure it out. And, like I said, I feel like, this is going to be a team that really benefits from Pat Kavanaugh's emergence as a more consistent offensive presence, because I don't think there's anybody else on that roster that I think Griffin Westlin is the athlete that keeps the pressure on, but I feel like Kavanaugh is the playmaker that is the that can be a straw who stirs the drink in a way that Westlin and Costabile cannot. But I also want to kind of shift that similar focus over to Maryland and say that between the shooting output, the short possessions, the fact that it's not as if that my overarching point with Maryland offensively right now is I feel like I feel like they intentionally are confusing. There isn't a ton of repetition. There isn't a ton of patterns that they're going to, aside from maybe a little bit of two-man action between Bernhardt and Wisnauskas, particularly with that flip that we saw Wisnauskas get a goal off of yesterday. And you've seen, to your point, contributions a little lower in the bench, and that makes up
Yeah, I
for a
like
guy
it.
like DeMayo not having the day that he had had a couple of days already so far this year, and that was kind of offset by Kyle Long providing a spark coming into this one.
It looks like Bubba Fairman's pressing a little. He had a, I believe, 0 for 11 shooting day. But at the end of the day, Maryland is averaging 16 goals a game right now. Okay, their defense is still the issue. They're averaging 12.4 goals against. That's not going to cut it later on in the year. That's what came back to bite them a year ago. But for anyone to talk about Maryland as a slowdown team, as a team who hasn't adjusted to the shot clock, they're not watching enough film because this Maryland team can score, especially considering they've played good teams. High Point and Richmond will battle for the SoCon title. Penn is an Ivy League potential champion. Villanova is as good as it gets in the Big East. Notre Dame is going to be I believe, a top-tier ACC team. So Maryland's played a really, really hard schedule, and they're scoring boatloads of goals. That's a good thing if you're John Tillman.
Last game that we're going to talk about on Saturday, Penn State 18, Penn 17 in overtime. Mac O'Keefe ended it with a unsettled goal off of a great ground ball by Jack Kelly. It kind of undid a really impressive offensive performance for the Quakers. A little bit of a coming out party for Dylan Guergar. And then Sean Lolley, oh my goodness, this guy, he's not quite in the Torton conversation just yet, but he had, I
Well, he
believe,
should
8
be.
points,
He
and
really.
people need to be paying attention to him.
It's a tough loss for Penn. As I said earlier, they just need to get better play between the pipes and in the clearing game. Too many turnovers, too many bad goals. And you go back a year ago, you think about losing in 2019 to Maryland by one, to Penn State by one, to Yale by one in the playoffs. Okay, this year they lose to Maryland in a close one.
They beat Duke
Got the Penn
14-11,
State loss.
and then they have the
They
Penn
beat
State
Duke
overtime loss.
and they
Yep.
lose to Penn State. So, I mean, you go back 2 years and there's a lot of high level, maybe about 5 1 goal games. They play a ton of 1 goal games overall, but man, I mean, they can, they're right there with everybody. Again, they're playing without Sam Handley, which is impressive. Lully has put together a number of performances that are just mind-boggling, big numbers. And then you got Goldner as the finisher. Bartolo can handle, he's a big guy. He can handle the downhill dodges, and it's just looking good with Guergar as well.
Well, let's quickly talk about Friday night. Syracuse beat Hobart 21-13 in the final game in the Carrier Dome this season as construction will begin to replace the roof on that legendary building. And the game that you were at, Duke 16, Richmond 15 in overtime. How did this one unfold from your perspective?
Ooh, I thought that Duke is fun to watch this year because I read about it in my poll on Monday. They're all over the map. There are times that Duke looks like a national title contender, and then there are other portions in a game where they look like the 30th ranked team in the country. So they're all over the map, and this is offensively, defensively, this is everything. Clearing, riding, nothing comes easy for this team, and there's a certain eye of the tiger quality I'm not sure they have, but they found it the other night. What I liked about this effort, the second midfield continues to be their primary scoring group. Caputo, Bedore, doing a nice job. For whatever reason, Nekhai Montgomery and Garrett Ledman are kind of struggling on that first group with Quigley. And the attack, they rotated a bunch of guys in. Basile played a lot. Muley got some runs outside of extra man. So I still think they're looking for answers on attack and the young defense. So it's it's still very much a work in progress. The cool thing about their win on Sunday, Terry, you just glanced over it early, but they won 19-6 over Furman. They had 18 different players score a point in that game.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, And John Donowski is playing 33-plus guys a game. So he's going to figure this out. I sense frustration in talking to him prior to the Richmond game. You know, he said, I'm frustrated, but we can't hit the panic button. We just got to, you know, clean some things up. Chase ground balls harder. Make better off-ball decisions defensively. Don't make bad slides creating offense. Offensively, make the right turn with the ball. Be accurate with your pull passes. Just honestly, it was all fundamentals. And at times in the game, they executed. But at other times, it kind of fell apart because they built that 14-10 lead. And then Richmond came right back into it. I was very impressed with a couple guys on Richmond. Adrian Nash, who's been a often injured backup middie, came on the scene. He had a hat trick. Schultz is a really good player. Cook defensively is one of my favorites. And then the freshman, we talked about it, Richie Connell, had a nice game as well. So High Point, who I got to see on Tuesday, Richmond, who I got to see on Friday, man, that's going to be a great game in the SoCon.
I went to Richmond's practice the fall of Adrian Nash's freshman year, and I've been waiting for that kid to break out ever since. And so watching that game on Friday night was a really cool experience where it was like, this is what I thought, this is the potential that I saw 4 years ago. And to your point, yeah, I mean, injuries and other types of issues like that, particularly when your team is having success, it can be one of those, it's just a challenge you got to navigate. And certainly with a senior season left in front of him, would like to see him continue to capitalize on that. But Quint, we are now positioned for what is one of the more interesting conversations that we could have right now, which is who's going to be number one in your poll. And the way that I see it, there are four teams with relatively equivalent claims for that top spot, and it really does kind of come down to preference. And you know, maybe
how many did you say? 14?
Four.
Did you say four or 14?
Four.
Okay. Who? Give me those four.
Okay, so I think that the justifiable the teams that you can justifiably have at number one are Syracuse, Carolina, Princeton, and Cornell. I think we're in a position where I'm only going to consider undefeated teams, and each of them have at least one quality enough win in order to be included in the conversation. And so depending on your preference.
Who's Cornell's quality win over?
Ohio State.
Okay, Ohio State's not in the top 20 right now.
Yeah, they are. They were number 18.
Okay. They're not in my top 20.
Okay.
North Carolina has one quality win over Denver, and the rest are all outside the RPI top, what, 40?
I mean, the RPI is not worth taking into consideration and using as a metric right now.
I'm just saying this. Princeton has the best resume on paper.
Yep. Because of their win, because their win over Virginia? You think their win at Virginia is – yeah, it's meaningfully better than Carolina's win at Denver.
I do. But I have Syracuse number one in my poll. I'll give it away.
And you got to read the rest of the poll. I
do not have those other teams one through four, though. I'll tell you that much.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if I will have them one through four. I think my point
is... I think Yale is better than Cornell. I think
Penn State is... I had Penn State number two
last week. I think Virginia is better than North Carolina. I've seen them both in person. I don't know.
So how good do you think
being undefeated is nice. That right now, I looked at it. There's six undefeateds in the country. We've got North Carolina, Georgetown 5-0, Syracuse, Princeton, Cornell, and Dartmouth. And what many of those teams have in common is that they really haven't played quality schedules. Georgetown in particular, and then Dartmouth as well. So being undefeated is nice, but it doesn't mean anything. Right now, you are not what your record says you are.
It does mean something.
Go back a week. Everyone was saying that Cornell was a great faceoff team.
If you have not lost yet, it means that your ceiling's not yet defined. I have felt this way forever.
No, watch the Cornell game today. Your eyes will tell you how good that defense is. And when they lose faceoffs to a team like Yale, when they lose faceoffs to a team like Penn, who have offenses that are light years ahead of wherever Ohio State's is, they will lose those ball games.
Well,
so,
you don't know that. You think they'll lose those games. And my point is that, until they actually do,
this is what I do.
If you're going to reward
being undefeated, I would say that there are two lost teams that are better than many of these undefeated teams.
That might be true, but that might be a valid opinion, but it is not.
And in the and right now, but right now, we're not basing everything on resume. because there's nothing substantial. You don't have
well, that's why,
you don't have the sample size.
You can
by the end of the
it
year,
everything.
It's based 100% on resume.
You can base
that's
everything
what the
on
NCAA
resume
committee
now.
Does. And as we head towards Selection Sunday, it becomes more and more and more resume related. Right now, iTest is I'm going with iTest because I know that North Carolina's defense is really going to struggle when they play a team like Virginia that can't win faceoffs. But I know that Virginia's defense will struggle with Carolina as well. Just giving that example, Syracuse is loaded, and I think if they, from a balance standpoint, that's why I give them the number one. Faceoffs, goaltending, strong up the middle, attacks not as great as you think they are. Outside of Chase Scanlon, they had 0 points against Army. First midfield is loaded. I like their depth. I think they're playing with a chip. I think they come into Baltimore, and we'll see how they play against Hopkins.
Well, that'll certainly set the table for an exciting week.
I mean, I had Carolina at 11 when I started my poll, and I moved them up to 7.
So
Duke beat Denver. What's so big about beating Denver these days?
You just totally stepped all over a really good, smooth transition into the end of the podcast. Unbelievable.
I wasn't done. I'm still not done.
All right.
We finally have an interesting discussion here, and you want to end this thing.
Yeah, because I want to keep the podcast like 30 minutes.
I got Penn State at two.
I also have – well, I don't necessarily have Penn State at two right now. I had them at two last week, and I'm going to see what the – rejiggering of the entire scenario looks like, because that's essentially, we're a month into the season, we have 2 months of the season to go. Now is a really good time to kind of draw a line in the sand and make a meaningful break from whatever ranking philosophy you might have adopted for the first month of the season and say, all right, the amount of evidence that's available is so much more meaningful and so much more substantial that if you were to transition from what your preseason expectations were, which was kind of on paper, into what your immediate first impression of a team was, which was very eye test oriented, into now trying to put together, you know, all of the independent and individualized data points into, you know, kind of an overarching matrix, I think that's a reasonable approach to take right now. And, you know, that's essentially what the next several hours of my life are going to entail.
Yeah, I mean, what do you do with Villanova? They played Penn State and Yale to open the season. They lost to those two teams. Both those two teams are got to be in your top eight.
Yep.
They beat Maryland.
Who's
they
probably
beat
also
Hofstra.
In the top
they beat
eight.
Delaware. They play Penn next weekend, so we find out. I think they're pretty good. And so I have Villanova higher than their record indicates because their two losses are to Penn State and Yale.
Yep.
I'm just using them as an example.
It'll be a fascinating thing to continue to watch as the season unfolds because certainly these strengths of schedule tend to gravitate towards, you know, something that is a little bit more convergent and, you know, consistent across quality programs. And I think that having, you know, a couple of wins over teams that rank in the bottom 20 or 30 right now can inflate a schedule in a way or inflate a record in a way that can be difficult to keep straight when you move from team to team. And I think Syracuse is a really good example of that. I think how a couple of these wins aside from the Army win are going to stack up at the end of the year are going to be really meaningful towards determining how valuable and how real is their 4-0. And truthfully, I don't think you're going to learn a ton about them against Johns Hopkins either.
No, I agree with that. And, you know, I could bring up your squad, your Loyola squad. I mean, Cleveland State's your real squad. But when you look at Loyola, if you said at the beginning of the year they would be, what, 4-1 at this point?
Yep.
You'd be like, yeah, we'll take that in a second. So that looks good. The negative there, though, is that Johns Hopkins is a non-top 20. Rutgers is a non-top 20. Towson is winless. Lafayette is probably a bottom top 20. So there's really nothing there. You know, if you go to the committee on Selection Sunday and say, we beat Rutgers, Johns Hopkins, and Towson, last year that would have been like, hey, step to the front of the line. This year it's like, yeah, okay, you rank 20th. You know what I mean in that regard, Terry?
And absolutely. I think
Loyola a lot of credit for their schedule. Unfortunately, things aren't breaking their way this year.
It will set the table for a nice week five, though. I do think that Loyola hosting Duke in the Ridley Athletic Complex is one of the signature matchups of the weekend. It is where I will be, and I look forward
absolutely.
To
what time's that start?
I'm sure it's a 1 o'clock, but I don't have that.
Gosh, why can't they stagger these games? Because you got Syracuse at Hopkins at 1. Why can't one play at noon and one play at 2:30? You know, and even like this last weekend, I know I'm going off here, but this last weekend, there's no game in Baltimore over the weekend. The only game was down in College Park between Towson, Hopkins, and Loyola. They're all either on the road or played on Friday. And I just think everyone's got to get together and put their schedules on a matrix and make it a little more fan-friendly.
You're going to appreciate this then. Towson, UMBC, and Navy all host games as well. All three start at noon.
That's, you know, counterproductive to growing the sport.
Quint, you have anything else you want to get off your chest? Hey, we got one more. Maryland hosts Albany at 1. Monte Mary's hosts Utah at 4. So if you want to get out and get an opportunity to get eyes on the Utes, you can probably make it out to Emmitsburg after catching one of those noon games.
No, I'm working with a niche on Saturday at Syracuse at Johns Hopkins. Say goodbye to the Dome for a while for the Orange. This will be good. I know Anish is digging up some ancient history when this game was rather important on the schedule. I'm just eager to see Syracuse in person.
All right, well, that'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart Podcast. Of course, if you like what you heard, which I don't understand how anybody could like what they heard with this podcast, but if
it
you
wasn't
did,
boring,
leave a rating and review, tell a friend, and as I said, we'll be back next week to talk about all of the exciting Week 5 action.
I love you, Foy. You know that.
Oh, you're the best.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.